Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. There are thousands of podcasts out there. You chose this one. It's your thing. Listening choices are part of who you are. And the choice to support your favorite NPR program is yours, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to donate to your station. Then share why that's the kind of person you are. Tweet or create a public Facebook post with the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Congress is expected to begin debate on a final Republican tax cut plan on Monday. It's not clear today that Republican leaders in the Senate have the votes to pass it. Vice President Mike Pence has postponed a trip abroad to be on hand for a possible tie-breaking vote. This morning on Fox News, South Dakota Republican John Thune praised the plan.
We're coming together behind a plan that does include basic features that we've all agreed on from the very beginning. The framework that was laid out earlier this year, double the standard deduction, it's going to double the child tax credit, lowers rates. That's going to deliver meaningful tax relief, bigger paychecks to American families, and higher wages for American workers.
Joining us now is Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon and the ranking member on the Senate Finance Committee. Senator, welcome back.
Thanks for having me again.
And have you seen the final bill, the final tax bill?
I have not. I am the ranking Democrat on the Senate Finance Committee. We are talking about $10 trillion worth of tax changes, an enormously important bill. I have not seen the bill that the Congress is going to be voting on very soon. And I think it really hammers home what happened yesterday. There was a conference committee, so-called, but it was really nothing more than a reality TV show that could give an episode of The Apprentice a run for its money. Normally, you have these conference committees, and there's supposed to be a back and forth. That's what you see in any civics book. But this was really used as a political tool yesterday to give the Republicans time to dot the I's and cross the T's on what has been a wholly secret backdoor tax deal.
Do you know when you're going to see a final version of the bill?
Well, we keep hearing rumors about it. And, you know, the press is full of all kinds of rumors. There's rumors about what's happening to the estate tax. There's rumors about what's happening to the corporate rate. There's rumors about a reduction in the top individual rate. But we do not have paper that in effect backs any of this up. What I can tell you is if you look at basically what the discussions among the Republicans have been all about over the last few days, it has been overwhelmingly about how to shovel more money at the folks who are already at the top. They're basically rearranging the chairs at the country club.
But one of the rumors is actually that the corporate tax rate would drop to 21% instead of 20%. Why is that? Do you think that's going to happen? And why do you think that would happen?
Again, I've heard the same rumor that everybody, you know, else has. I never had a single company tell me that they had to have a corporate rate as low as 21%. Most of them would be very pleased if you got into the middle 20s. And each one of these points that goes down is worth essentially $100 billion over 10 years. So the reduction in tax breaks for the multinational corporations would be permanent. So in effect, what the Republicans are doing is writing in to black letter law a double standard. Permanent breaks for the well-connected, the multinational corporations, temporary breaks for the middle class. And based on what we know from the earlier discussions, the temporary breaks, such as in the Senate bill, is come 2027, something like half of the middle class would see a significant tax increase.
So do you believe that Republicans have the votes that they need to pass this bill?
This fight is far from over, Jeremy. Number one, Bob Corker already voted with us, so we have some indication that he's open. The folks in the House of Representatives show no willingness to support Senator Collins on what she said was her bottom line, trying to get changes in the Affordable Care Act involving what's called cost sharing and reinsurance. Senator Rubio has been very troubled about the fact that this is so tilted against the middle class. Senator Flake has been very concerned about the deficits, as has Senator McCain. And there was another poll that came out yesterday that showed how unhappy the middle class is with something like this. The middle class drives the American economy. They're responsible for 70% of the American activity. And yet this has given money mostly to multinational corporations that are awash in cash right now.
So do you think you'll be able to get any of those senators, Senator Flake, Senator Collins, Senator McCain, to come over to your side and vote against the final tax bill?
I always like the Yogi Berra comment. I don't do predictions, especially about the future. But what I can tell you is this fight is far from over.
So we've got this fight, which is about tax cuts. There's also a question of whether the government's going to shut down next week. Do you have anything to offer there? Is that likely?
I continue to believe that Americans don't like this kind of playing chicken with shutdowns. And, you know, we're very concerned about the programs for the vulnerable. And frankly, those concerns in the end of the year bill are even more important right now, because we learned here recently that Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, has said the first bill, the very first bill he wants to bring up after tax legislation is considered, is so-called entitlement reform, which is really code for going after programs like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid and anti-hunger programs. So that has elevated the importance of the end of the year agreement. And then I care very deeply about a fair shake for the Dreamers. I think these young people have done absolutely nothing wrong. I meet so many with perfect grades, working two jobs, sending money, you know, to family. These are exactly the kind of young people who are doing what we expect of folks who are contributing in America.
But you don't expect there to be a deal on DACA next week, do you?
Well, we're going to continue to push. We're going to push every single step of the way. And I personally think there should have been a deal on the Dreamers and DACA some time ago. So we're going to keep pushing, and that's the way you get political change.
That's Senator Ron Wyden, a Democrat from Oregon and the ranking member on the Senate Finance Committee. Senator, thank you.
Jeremy, let's do it again. Thanks so much.
Well, today marks the fifth anniversary of the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, which stunned but also refocused attention on how schools should prepare for such horror. And today, the strategies run the gamut, from the kind of lockdown that's credited with saving lives during a shooting at a California elementary school last month to arming teachers. As NPR's Athathi Bunlamudi reports, experts disagree on what's best.
Students and staff are performing an active shooter drill at Las Cruces High School in New Mexico.
Okay, guys, listen up. There's an announcement.
Teachers and students, please listen to the following announcement. The school is under lockdown. The school is under lockdown.
In this training video, the teacher turns off the lights, locks the door, and places a black strip of paper over the door's window. The students close the blinds and huddle on the floor, away from the windows.
Okay, guys, we're in a lockdown. You know what you're supposed to do?
Schools across America have adopted procedures for what to do if someone opens fire, and drill students so they know what to do in that situation. There are more than 50 school shootings, on average, every year in the U.S. In just the past month, two students died at a shooting at another high school in New Mexico, and an elementary school in Northern California was targeted in a shooting rampage. 26 children and educators died at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut in 2012. Joe Irardi started as superintendent in Newtown Public Schools in the wake of that tragedy.
In essence, I had two full-time jobs. One was to run the school district, and the second was to do the absolute best that I could with putting in extraordinary amounts of time pertaining to the safety and security of all students and staff.
Irardi worked with local law enforcement to identify best practices. He says they found it's important to let students know exactly why these drills are necessary. Don't sugarcoat it. And if it happens in your school, he says,
one of the things you would never do would be evacuate, because all you're doing is putting people in harm's way.
But not everyone agrees. Greg Crane is the founder of a school safety training program that's used in over 4,000 schools. He says fatalities in Columbine and Newtown were high because schools strictly followed their lockdown procedures and didn't evacuate. In the Columbine High School shooting, 15 people died.
We should never have such a high lethality rate, but we have such a high lethality rate because his objective of hurting people becomes too easy because they've been taught to sit still and be an easy target.
Here's the thing. different schools have different approaches. Some rely on safety officers to determine the best response to an active shooter, depending on the circumstances. That could mean evacuating through the closest exit, even if that's through a window, or hunkering down and waiting.
Don't give me just one option, because you can't know today that that's going to be the right one for me tomorrow.
A number of factors can determine the best strategy for a school, experts say. Shireen Walter is with the California Parent Teacher Association. Her daughter teaches at a California elementary school that has an open floor plan.
You know, the common wisdom is that you're going to lock down, you're going to lock your doors, and the kids are going to hide in a corner. My daughter's classroom doesn't have a door. So a one-size-fits-all safety plan of lock your door and hide isn't going to work for her classroom.
But the lack of consensus among experts leaves some educators and parents frustrated. Elizabeth Davis heads the Teachers Union of Washington, D.C. She says schools need clear instructions for how to respond, not a menu of options.
My point is it should be systemic. It should not be random.
The director of public safety for Las Cruces Public Schools in New Mexico says whenever another school shooting happens in the U.S., he tries to learn from it. For now, the plan is to lock down the school, evacuate if necessary, and then fight in self-defense, if it comes to that. Aditi Bandlamudi, NPR News.
Russian President Putin held his annual marathon press conference today, speaking for nearly 4 hours, taking questions from foreign and domestic journalists on subjects ranging from North Korea to alleged collusion with the 2016 Trump campaign. NPR's Moscow correspondent Lucian Kim was watching, and Lucian, over 1,600 journalists were there. Why does Putin do this every year?
You know, that's the one question I wish people would ask him. There is a Kremlin pool of reporters, and they travel around with him. And, you know, sometimes they get a shout-out questions in their press conferences with foreign leaders, but really not a whole lot of opportunities to talk with Putin. Part of his style, he's very staged. And even today, there wasn't really a chance for any kind of follow-up questions.
Okay, so what were some of the answers today? He was asked about alleged collusion between the Russian government and the Trump campaign. What did he say?
Well, as far as collusion, he answered the usual way, the way he always has. His point is this is an invention of Trump's political enemies who simply can't accept his victory. It maybe sounds a lot like what Trump says himself. Mm. What he did say today was that Washington was gripped in what he called spy mania. And he basically brushed off those accusations and said he really hopes that he and Donald Trump at some point will be able to normalize relations.
Well, Putin was also asked by Ksenia Sobchak, who's a liberal TV presenter who is herself planning to run against him in 2018, about the lack of political competition against him and why the opposition candidate Alexei Navalny has been barred from running. Interesting moment there. How did Putin respond?
It was very interesting. Well, first of all, Putin did not even mention Navalny's name. He just said, this personage. And whenever Putin doesn't say your name, it's one way of knowing he doesn't really like you very much. Yeah, the question was, is the government scared of honest competition? And he said no. But he said Navalny is sort of bringing a street revolution and chaos to Russia. And he says, that's exactly what we saw happen in Ukraine 4 years ago, and Russians don't want that. What Putin said is the opposition must bring something constructive and something positive and not destructive.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see how that plays out. There's the 2018 Winter Olympics. The International Olympic Committee banning Russia as a country. Some of the athletes can still come if they can get through the testing, but banning the country because of its widespread doping program in the last Olympics. What did he say?
Well, he kind of put forward this conspiracy theory that it's not a coincidence that all of these decisions by the IOC are happening now, right in advance of the Russian presidential election, which takes place in March. So he was kind of tying that into some way of influencing domestic Russian politics.
Mm. Okay. He also praised Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. We reported yesterday how Tillerson said that the U.S. would love to have talks with North Korea with no preconditions. You know, just come. We'll talk. Talk about the size of the table. Of course, the Trump administration immediately said, no. We still want some preconditions like, you know, shutting down their weapons program. And so Putin praised Tillerson and accused the U.S. of provoking North Korea. So how is Putin positioning Russia in this conflict?
Well, that's right. I mean, he actually started out making fun of U.S. lawmakers. He said, well, you guys, you know, put Russia on the same level as Iran and North Korea, and now you guys are running to us asking, you know, for help in negotiating some kind of agreement with North Korea. At the same time, he did say he thought Tillerson's proposal was, in his words, a good signal. As far as sort of the bigger picture of Russia on the world stage, I think Putin actually quite enjoys the role that Russia is playing. And who knows, maybe we'll be hearing about a Russian initiative at some point, the same way that Russia has been trying to play this intermediary role in the peace process in Syria.
NPR Moscow correspondent Lucian Kim, thank you so much.
Great talking to you, Robin.
Well, here in the U.S., it was a year of hurricanes, wildfires, shootings, so many incidents so fast that the Las Vegas Review-Journal speculates that's why fundraising for victims of the worst mass shooting in modern American history in Las Vegas is lagging because people moved on to other things. We wanted to check back in with survivor David Holly when the gunman opened fire into an outdoor music festival on October 1st, killing 58, wounding 546. This 26-year-old was shot in the elbow. His girlfriend's head was grazed by a bullet. Both bled profusely. A bystander drove them to a hospital in his Mercedes. We spoke with David a few days later.
He actually bandaged me up, and he said, we need to get you guys to an ambulance. And at that point, I just begged him to get us to a hospital.
Well, David Holly joins us again. David, how are you and Stephanie, your girlfriend, doing?
We are doing really good. Well, actually, she's fully recovered. She's back at work full time. She's doing better with her sleeping, but I know I have issues that are arising from it, so I know eventually I'll seek counseling probably for some help.
Yeah, because we talked to you about that then. So you haven't yet sought any counseling?
No.
Yeah. What do you see the things rising with you that make you think you're going to need some help?
Just, I guess, more so the flashbacks. Everything that I saw that night while trying to figure out the best way of getting out, I could replay it all in my head like I was there again.
Yeah, I can't imagine. And here you were shot in the elbow. Have you been able to return to work?
I am back at work, but on light duty, so pretty much I push papers now. I'm still getting movement back in my hand. The bullet nicked my ulna nerve, which affects my two right-hand fingers, so my pinky and my ring finger. So I'm not going to be allowed to go back to turning wrenches until I can have full movement back in my hand.
Yeah. And talk about, you know, the other thing you said to us is that you wished you knew who these people were that kept you guys from bleeding to death and put you, as bloody as you were, into their Mercedes. That sticks with me somehow. And you finally met them. How did you find them?
Actually, I happened to just be trying to do some research, trying to find out any updates as far as anything new on the shootings or anything, if they had found anything new. And I just happened to run across another article that a news company out of Arizona had done. And just started reading it, and it mentioned mine and Stephanie's names, and then everything, I guess, started coming back, I guess, the best way I could put that.
They were telling the story of how they had rescued you and brought you to the hospital, and this, it turns out, was an EMT who, with his girlfriend, was at the concert as well, lucky you. This is David Hendrickson, and he also talked about that night, you know, they're trying to race you to the hospital. They don't know where the hospitals are. There's another pickup truck that drives over the median with even more injured people in it. And then you met them. What was that like? You met up with them.
Bittersweet is the best way I could put that. It was great getting to actually put a face with the name again instead of everything being chaotic. We went out, had dinner, we had drinks, and we reminisced about everything that had happened. And hopefully we have a lifelong friendship that's going to come out of it.
We heard you say that you found them because you were looking for information. You know, and one of the unanswered questions is, why did this gunman do this? Is that one of the things that keeps you searching?
Yeah, because, I mean, there's just a dozen questions of just trying to find out, or what has law enforcement found? I mean, It seems like everything on the media has just stopped about it, and there's still a lot of people wondering.
Yeah. Listen, I know your medical bills piled up because you were out of work for so long, both you and Stephanie. And your thoughts on what we're reading in the Las Vegas Review-Journal, that the fundraising has really not been what people thought it might be. Nearly four times as much was raised after the 2013 Boston Marathon attack than has been raised so far for Las Vegas. Not just people like yourself who've been injured, but family members of the 58 people who've died. double was raised after the 2016 Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, Florida. There's a lot of speculation that it's just there was so much stuff going on this year that the spotlight moved on. Another thought is that there's so many individual fundraising groups now, GoFundMe and stuff. So maybe that's splintered the fundraising. But your thoughts on that?
It is what it is. I mean, honestly, if nothing really comes out of my pocket, I'm happy. I mean, it's a crappy scenario no matter what. So, I mean, if it helps burden it, I mean, I know I lost work. I know I lost all that, but I can recover from that.
Do you have a GoFundMe page?
No, we decided not to do one just under the fact of we decided there's people far worse off than we were. Stephanie's friends from her work decided to do a car wash for us, which helped out with a couple of the bills.
Well, according to some reports, there are at least 167 crowdfunding campaigns for specific individuals after the Las Vegas shooting. That was in October, so there's probably more now. And as you said, of the 546, there are a lot of people, you know, terribly injured. David, are you in touch with some of the other people who were shot?
I know Stephanie talks to a lot of the people on the survivors page. I personally have kind of just kept myself away from everything.
Why?
I think it's just I'm reserved like that. My way of getting past everything is I try not to talk about it and just kind of keep going on.
Well, from what Stephanie says, what would you want people to know about the people injured in Las Vegas?
I mean, none of us were out there really looking for any trouble. People have put out that every country music fan is a Trump supporter and hate pretty much and is racist and all that. And all of us were out there just to have a good time. So, I mean, people are turning it into politics and everything else. And in all the reality, it was one angry person that was mad at the world or mad at for whatever reasons and decided to take it out on people that were having a good time trying to forget about life for a weekend.
Well, we just wish you the best. We hope you get back to the work you really want to do with your hands.
Thank you.
Yeah, we hope you get some peace.
I'm sure it will come. I mean, it helped out a lot meeting David and Michelle, so.
Yeah. That's David Holly of Victorville, California. He and his girlfriend Stephanie were rescued by David and Michelle in the aftermath of the Las Vegas shooting when David Holly and his girlfriend Stephanie Gonzalez-Nieves were both shot. David Holly, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Walt Disney Company has announced it will buy major parts of 21st Century Fox for more than $52 billion. Fox News and the Fox TV network will remain separate entities. Emily Glazer is a reporter with the Wall Street Journal, which we should note is owned by News Corporation, one part of the Rupert Murdoch media empire. Emily, Disney already has a huge media empire. Why do they want to acquire these parts of Fox?
It's a great question, Jeremy. You know, media companies like Disney and Fox are increasingly concerned that the biggest competitive threats in the future won't come from rivals, but actually from technology companies like the Netflix and Amazons of the world, among others. And beyond that, Disney CEO Bob Iger wants to strengthen Disney's largest bill of business, television. And it's actually taken a hit as consumers have cut back on traditional cable packages and spend more time with digital providers. Buying Fox would also get Disney's collection of franchises huge boost. So that's things like Fox's Avatar franchise, X-Men, and let's not forget The Simpsons.
And you mentioned Netflix and Amazon. Should they be worried about this deal, about seeing a bigger Disney as a bigger competitor to them?
I think it'd be silly if they weren't giving the size and scale of Disney, thinking that there's some threat by that. But at the same time, the tech firms are at a great advantage. Netflix and Amazon have built substantial subscription businesses. I watch both of them myself by reaching consumers directly, and they're investing huge amounts of dollars in original programming. So many people talk about how there's just so much content out there now, so many new TV shows, so many documentaries, so many films. And on the other spectrum, there's Facebook and Google, who are winning an overwhelming share of digital advertising dollars.
Now, why does Rupert Murdoch want to sell off this big chunk of 21st Century Fox, but keep Fox News and the Fox TV network?
So my colleagues reported in a front page Wall Street Journal story a few weeks ago that back in October, Bob Iger, Disney's CEO, phoned Rupert Murdoch and he proposed a purchase that would hive off, you know, these Fox assets. And what we reported at the time was that these changes in the media landscape had really changed Rupert Murdoch's thinking. You know, he spent decades and his whole career building up this media empire. But there are questions about the family succession plans. Mr. Murdoch is 86 years old. He has two sons, James and Lachlan, that are both in their 40s, and the elevation of them to different roles has hit some roadblocks. We reported at that time that the Murdochs have also questioned whether their company would be big enough in these years ahead to battle, you know, the Netflixes and Amazons and others in this space. So I think it's a bunch of different issues at play here.
Are Disney and Fox likely to see any trouble with regulators over this, especially given that the Justice Department is opposing the merger of AT&T and Time Warner?
It's certainly a question, and my colleagues Ben Fritz and others have definitely weighed in on this. You know, the Justice Department, like you mentioned, has sued to block AT&T's attempt to buy Time Warner, and that signals that a deal where a major content distributor like Comcast or others is heavily scrutinized. So with Disney and Fox, they're expecting there to be scrutiny. What Bob Iger has said is that regulators and lawmakers will, quote, look at this from a consumer point of view, and if they look at it from a consumer point of view, they should quickly conclude that the aim of this combination is to create more high-quality product.
That's Emily Glazer, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Emily, thank you.
Thank you.
Like a lot of boys and girls, your posture is your problem. What are you going to do about it?
I'll tell you what I'm going to do about it. I'm going to make you reflect what I want to see. Because I'm going to have good posture. You just wait and see.
A clip from a 1953 instructional film about posture. Turns out all these years later, we could still afford to learn a thing or two about good posture. And we're joined by Rupal Patel, who's a physical therapist at Bodywise Physical Therapy in Austin, Texas. Rupal, welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
And let's start with the basic question. What is good posture?
So to me, good posture is carrying your body in a way that is mechanically safe. So that means that your spine is in its natural curves, which allows the muscles to activate from the inside out and gives us a solid foundation for when we need to move.
And why is it so important to have that good posture?
So if we sit in poor posture for long periods of time, essentially our brain begins to create a strong connection between the way that we're sitting and how we want our muscles to be activated all the time, right? So we begin to create these pathways, which are essentially shortcuts. And so instead of our brain being wired to access movement in a mechanically sound way, it then starts to access movement more from the outside in, which essentially sets us up for injury down the line.
What do you mean? What are the possible complications from bad posture?
So it's kind of like if you woke up on a Saturday morning and you jumped in your car to go to your kid's soccer game and instead ended up at work. So essentially what happens is our brain, because of its neural plasticity and because of how intelligent it is, it really takes note of how we're holding our bodies. So when we hold ourselves in poor posture over a long period of time, essentially what happens is we're shortening certain muscles and lengthening other muscles. And that muscle memory essentially changes the way that our brain is accessing the movement through the muscles. And so when we recruit the muscles, say, in an activity such as soccer or rock climbing or whatever we might be doing on the weekends, that is the same way our brain is going to access our muscles to be used in those settings as well. So therefore, it kind of sets your body up for incongruency and injury.
And would it be just as simple as you have a bad back after you've had bad posture for a long time, or can it lead to other health problems?
For sure. It can definitely lead to, you know, a myriad of musculoskeletal issues like neck pain, back pain, shoulder issues. You know, the tendonitis that you thought was coming from your tennis could actually be coming as a result of the poor posture that you've been exhibiting, you know, day in and day out.
So does good posture come naturally, or is it something that we learn when we're young and it sticks with us?
So it's a combination of a couple things. Again, coming back to this idea that when we sit in a long periods of time with poor posture, our brain will learn and adapt to wanting to kind of be in that posture. That being said, our body always remembers how to sit or stand with the good posture. It's more of a subconscious battle to kind of bring us back to that place and hold it and assume it for longer periods of time.
So if you've got bad posture, and by the way, I don't think I have terrible posture, but I do find myself sometimes slouching when I'm sitting down in a chair like anybody does. Is there a way to fix that?
Sure. Yeah, so a great way to think of it is you can imagine your pelvis being in the shape of a bowl. And you can also imagine your rib cage being in the shape of a bowl, except that bowl is upside down. So you can kind of picture that these two bowls sit on top of one another. And if you're slouching forward, for example, if you are in an upright kind of military posture, you'll notice that both of those bowls are open to the front. And so any water, let's say, that's in those bowls is going to be spilling forward. If you're slouching in the opposite direction so that your shoulders are hunched forward and your head is coming forward on your body, you'll notice that those bowls are going to open up to the back. And so a really good and simple way to kind of bring you back to that natural balance would be to balance those two bowls on top of one another so that there is no opening.
What about your shoulders? How should you be holding your shoulders?
Generally speaking, people when they're sitting at their desks, a lot of times they are, you know, under a lot of stress, and so their shoulders start to creep up towards their ears. And the best way to think about your shoulders is to let them be heavy. So I always tell people, you know, think about your shoulder blades like slices of butter melting down your back into your back pocket. We want to try to avoid forcing them down or pulling them in, because that's going to create another muscle imbalance. And so, again, it's about that awareness of letting them stay heavy as well.
But basically keeping them right on the sides of your body rather than forward or back.
Correct.
And can you live a life as comfortably when you do that as when you just sit the way that you would normally sit?
Sure. It's actually very comfortable if you can find that position and sustain it, because your body knows how to be there. Your muscles, actually, we have two different sets of muscles. We have an internal set and we have an external set. And so when you start to sit with good posture and you feel that muscle fatigue that sets in, that's because the external set of muscles is working too hard to hold you upright, which is really not their job. The internal set of muscles, the ones that help stabilize the bones in the body, they're essentially our foundation for stability and movement. And so when those muscles are active, it really shouldn't feel like it's too much work for us to stay upright against gravity.
I've seen some tips that you've put out there, which include setting an alarm every hour to check on how you're doing with your posture.
Yeah, I think it's a good practice to do little things such as, you know, drinking lots of water to make sure you're getting up and go to the restroom, just to give yourself that reset whenever you sit back down, or if you have a standing desk, same concept, just standing in a way that is good for your body.
What percentage of Americans would you say need work on their posture?
I would say close to 100%, myself included.
Really? Why do you think that is?
We're sitting for longer periods of time than we ever have historically. And realistically, our bodies are meant to be moving around in different ways and spaces, right? And, you know, technology is definitely not helping us in that arena either.
We're spending a lot of time looking down at our phones.
Correct. So I think the best thing to do about that is to definitely limit your phone time, maybe give yourself, you know, a cap on how much extended periods of time you're going to spend on your phone. Trying to bring your phone up to your face rather than your head down to your phone is another good tip. With the advent of standing desks, which is definitely a great addition to an office space, unfortunately, in my opinion, I don't think that's the solution to our sitting problems. I think that down the line, you know, 10 or 15 years when there's research on that, we're going to start to see other things emerge from the standing desk, because just standing is not enough. We have to be conscious about the way that we're standing, just like we were talking about with the way that we're sitting.
How much does sleep matter in the way that we're sleeping?
So with sleep, I always tell people that your body, again, is going to tell you when you need to switch positions. There is no one ideal position that works for everybody, and there's not one mattress that works for everybody. I think the best thing for sleep is making sure that you're getting good quality sleep so that you can function optimally and your immune system is up to par.
Does posture always get worse as we get older?
I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. I mean, it definitely seems like as we age, we lose height in the discs and in the spine, but it's not an inevitable thing. We can definitely stay in a middle ground.
I have a friend who was in the military, and he has got the best posture I've ever seen in my life. Every time I'm with him, he's just sitting perfectly straight up. Probably a lot of people in the military are like that. Why is that? What do they know that we don't?
I think it's probably the discipline. You know, they're probably not sitting on couches neither as much as we are.
So what would be your one piece of advice for people out there listening to this about how to improve their posture?
So my piece of advice, because I get asked a lot about the best chairs and the best mattresses and the best pillows, et cetera. And my best piece of advice is to make sure that your body feels grounded and it feels balanced when you're sitting, because that's the best tool that we have for feedback for ourselves is our body and how we feel inside of it.
That's Rupal Patel, who is a physical therapist at Bodywise Physical Therapy in Austin, Texas. Rupal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yemen was already on shaky ground before the war that began in 2015. Now more than 8,000 people have been killed, thousands more hurt, millions displaced. The fighting is between forces loyal to the internationally recognized government, backed by Saudi Arabia, and those allied to the Houthi rebel movement, backed by Iran. The country's former president, Ali Abdullah Saleh, was just killed by Houthi rebels on December 4th as he tried to flee clashes with his allies turned foes in Sana'a, Yemen's capital. It's complicated, but he'd reportedly criticized the Houthi rebels for launching that missile that reached the Saudi airport. CNN's Clarissa Ward is one of the few journalists to get into Yemen. She's back in London now and joins us by Skype. And Clarissa, risky mission for you, but I know you want us to get to this huge humanitarian crisis. Tell us first, the war itself, this proxy war, where are we in this war?
Essentially, what you have at the moment is the country has been cleaved in two. In the north, you have these Iran-backed Houthi rebels who control the capital, Sana'a, and much of the north of the part of the country. And then in the south, you have the Saudi Arabia-led coalition that is largely in control. But the issue is that within the south, what you actually see is a patchwork of different militias, all of them vying for power. And that's what makes it very difficult and dangerous to cover. There are no blanket rules across the country. Each patch of territory is controlled by someone different.
Well, and so many problems, a cholera epidemic, a huge population of orphans. We spoke to a Yemeni refugee whose concern were the young people who were being taken by militant groups and kind of outsourced to other countries to fight terrorist wars, you know, being sent to countries in Africa, for instance, and just no medical supplies. Look, you went to a hospital, medical waste festering outside, Al-Qaeda graffiti on the walls. You meet doctors from aid organizations there trying to help. A mother who brought her 3-year-old son, Hazar, for treatment. He had a serious lung infection for weeks. Let's listen.
Life is hard since the war. Disease has spread, she tells me. He's my only child.
The family's
Chicago pediatrician.
And then you introduce us to this pediatrician. Who is he and what is he doing in Yemen?
So his name is Dr. John Kaler, and he has worked in some of the most difficult and dangerous places in the world, including Aleppo, Syria, when it was under siege. He's also done incredible work in Haiti, essentially traveling to some of the most vulnerable and violent spots on the planet. He's part of a larger organization called Med Global. I think he would be the first to admit that his efforts to work in Yemen have been extremely extremely frustrating because it's so difficult to get to the areas that are the hardest hit. Yemen is a place where access is a very elusive thing. And to get even just 2 hours outside of the southern capital of Aden can take days and weeks of planning. And I do think that's enormously frustrating. It's also a big factor as to why it is that you see this desperate humanitarian crisis, why aid is not getting to where it needs to go. Although, of course, the primary thing that is driving this crisis is the Saudi Arabia-led blockade, air, sea, land blockade, that has cut the amount of food, fuel, medicine getting into the country by more than half.
And of course, Saudi Arabia would say that it is threatened by the militants in Yemen, as witnessed the missile that just landed just outside their airport recently. Look, when you talk about the doctor's frustration, this young boy that we meet, you know, he doesn't make it. You know, it's just heartbreaking. And you know, it doesn't seem as if many of the other children there who are being cared for by their mothers with these doctors, because there's so few staff, doesn't seem like they're going to make it.
And this is what was so hard about covering this story. I'm used to seeing terrible things, but the number of children who are dying in Yemen, it just beggars belief. And they're not dying because they're being shot or blown up. It's not bullets and bombs that are killing them. It's this humanitarian crisis. It's the fact that a mother can't afford to make the six-hour bus journey to a city to take her son to the hospital and get him treated for what probably was a very common and easily treatable and preventable lung infection. It's the fact that the hospital, the main hospital in Aden, doesn't have soap for doctors to properly wash their hands. These are very basic needs that in this day and age, to see them ultimately resulting in the death of children, it's incredibly difficult to try to wrap your head around that.
Mm. Well, hopefully the right heads will see it and try to maybe come to a solution here. CNN's Clarissa Ward in London, and we'll link you to her reports from Yemen at hereandnow.org. You can also still see them on CNN. Clarissa, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.